This program is brought to you by ExpressVPN. Protect yourself from Big Brother and Big Tech by going to expressvpn.com/Dinesh. Book burning comes to America. Why people do racial hoaxes. And Marjorie Taylor Greene joins me to talk about stopping HR1, Biden's infrastructure program, and a whole lot more. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Podcast.
America needs this voice. The times are crazy. In a time of confusion, division, and lies, we need a brave voice of reason, understanding, and truth. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Podcast.
Book burning has now come to America. It is book burning in a new form. I would call it stealth book burning. But in some ways, it's even more insidious than the public ritual of book burning. Now, book burning is symbolized in a very gruesome way by the infamous Nazi book burning. This was in May of 1933. It was organized by Joseph Goebbels. It occurred actually on several campuses around Germany. And we recreated the scene in my movie, Death of a Nation. Here's a short clip of it. Listen.
The Nazi concept was called Gleichschaltung, which means bringing all the cultural institutions in line with Nazi ideology. This was the significance of the Heil Hitler salute and the draping of swastika flags off balconies. These things signaled humble conformity, the Nazi doctrine.
So as you can see from the clip, the book burning is part of a larger thing. First of all, the book burnings occurred in 34 different towns in Germany. It wasn't a single place. And after the book burning, a lot of these Nazi youth would go to publishers, they would go to warehouses, they would call for books to be removed, banned, libraries. And the idea here was to, quote, clean up Germany, to remove the contamination of dangerous books. And what were these dangerous books? Well, very often they were books by other German writers, Heinrich Heine, Bertolt Brecht. People like this were targeted for their books to be eradicated and literally set to the flames. Now, this has become a symbol of intolerance, of Nazi hatred. And I think in America, the left, although they've done some book burnings, there was a book burning of some Bibles that occurred in the aftermath of the Black Lives Matter protests. But by and large, the book burning is a stealth book burning. It's the book burning of Amazon, for example, not featuring books to sell, publishers withdrawing books from publication, professors not assigning books in class, removing them from circulation, making them difficult to obtain, people being suppressed on social media for their ideas. And then in some ways, self-censorship. I noticed this because this even happens. We have this discussion, Debbie and I do, typically when we're thinking about the podcast. She'll say, well, you know, if you talk about this, you run the risk of being kicked off YouTube. You know, if you do this, Facebook could demonetize you or ban you or flag you. And it is amazing that, you know, we're talking here not about me reciting epithets or denouncing some ethnic group, none of that. We're talking about legitimate debates in the mainstream of American politics having to do with the most current issues of the day. My friend, Debbie's friend, Joe Pags, a radio host, was thrown off Twitter. Was thrown off Twitter for what? For a hashtag, hydroxychloroquine works. Can you imagine? And now, of course, there are multiple studies showing that hydroxychloroquine does help. But at the time, this was taboo. This was, quote, misinformation. Think of who makes these decisions. Who decides what's misinformation? I know with other, this podcast is sponsored by Salem, and I've got these co-hosts at Salem, people like Eric Metaxas, Sebastian Gorka, and Pags, of course, is not on Salem, but he's also in the radio world. And all these guys have been dinged for this and zinged for that. And here is Abigail Schreier. Abigail Schreier is a writer who has written a book about the trans phenomenon. Now, interestingly, she's not against trans adults, but she noticed something very strange, which is that there is a huge increase, or an almost preposterous increase in young people, young children, particularly teenage girls, identifying as trans. In Great Britain, for example, the number of teenage girls identifying as trans is up 4,400%. And so naturally, this is kind of a remarkable phenomenon. If being trans is something that has always been around, why the surge now? What's going on? And basically, Abigail Schreier finds out that what's going on is that there is this kind of cultural pressure going on, and there is a kind of abdication by the medical community. You got these young girls who are lonely, they're confused, and so when they go to seek help, they say, well, you know, I'm wondering about my sexuality. I sometimes wonder if I'm too much like a boy. Right away, the medical professionals go, oh, we've got to affirm you in your new identity. We've got to start giving you testosterone shots. And so you've got this abuse of medical practice. In any event, whatever you think of all this, this is a book discussing all of this and discussing it in an intelligent way. And so what happens? Target and Amazon just pulled the book. You can't buy it there. And not only that, but the ACLU, an organization established to defend civil liberties, sides with the book burners. One of the ACLU lawyers, unbelievably, is quoted as saying that this is a hill. Suppressing this book, he says, I'm going to quote him, stopping this book is a hill that he's willing to die on. Die on. This is, by the way, a trans ACLU type. All kinds of people write Abigail Schreier and say, your book is really good, but we can't say that publicly. So these are medical professionals, these are people in the media, and Abigail Schreier rightly says that what you have here is an atmosphere of fear, and people are reluctant to come to your defense. There was a demonstration in Canada. This was the LGBTQ group, which basically said that they are going to dissociate themselves from a library, a public library, because this book was damaging to trans people. To even discuss this topic in this way is damaging. And so the Halifax Pride, this is the annual LGBTQ festival, said we're going to cut ties with this library system. So the library tried to negotiate with them. This is basically how libraries get into the book burning business. And said, listen, well, why don't we direct everyone who asks for this book to a list of, quote, trans-affirming resources. But these guys were like, no, that's not going to do it. We're not satisfied. We want this book out. And so in a library of 1.2 million volumes, this book and one other book were targeted. They just could not be even included. And interestingly, and we're now talking about Canada, the Nova Scotia Library Association, the Canadian Library Association, dead silent. You would think that they would step in for free speech. But no, ironically, this great important value of free speech developed in Western civilization that's been a great engine of open inquiry. Open inquiry not just in the public square for politics, but a great engine of open inquiry for scholarly investigation, for advancement in the sciences, for advancements in the law, because, of course, the legal system depends on discovery, depends upon a kind of open-mindedness. But it's being shut down all over the place. And this is the new form of book burning. Essentially, the fear that people suffer, well, partly it's the fear that you'll be thrown off social media. Partly it's the fear you'll lose your job. But it's also, Abigail Schreier says, it's the fear of ostracism. Ostracism is a very powerful force in society. It's the fear that you'll be, quote, excommunicated from society. You'll be treated as a pariah. And going back to the ancient Greeks actually had this sort of policy of ostracizing people, which is banishing them from society. And some people thought it was so awful that they would prefer death to ostracism, because being cut off from a community, Aristotle says that man is a social animal. To be cut off from the society that is yours and that you value is, in a sense, to face a certain kind of social death or a social extinction. The Nazis understood book burning, and they had this public liturgy of book burning. In America, book burning takes a different form. a quieter form. Don't burn the book. You don't have to burn the book. The book isn't even available for sale. No one's going to see it anyway. This may not be called book burning, but it's book burning all the same. I'm really excited to have back my friend Marjorie Taylor Greene. She really doesn't need any introduction. She's a newly elected congresswoman, but she has become one of the most high-profile members of Congress. Marjorie, welcome to the podcast. Great to have you. Well, let me start with the fact that, you know, most people couldn't give the name of their own member of Congress, their own representative. You have become, I think it's fair to say, a household name. So let me start by asking you, how did you do it? What's the key to your success?
Yes, that was certainly something I didn't expect, especially my first few months in Congress. And I don't think I achieved that on my own. The media did that for me. The media decided to create a character of me that basically doesn't exist. And then that's the person they wanted to tell the world about. And so that's what they did. But and the reason why they did it is because I came into Congress with a plan, and that is to represent the American people and to put people over politicians, and to push really hard for America First policies and hold Congress accountable. Because as a successful business owner, I believe that Congress needs to be held accountable to the American people and the taxpayers. And that is a threat to this establishment here in the swamp. And they have definitely treated me like a threat. And so, well, yeah, the media helped out.
But I think you're a threat, Marjorie, also because of the way that you are fearless and the way that you respond to them. You don't take any of their nonsense. You keep going. You don't show that kind of trademark Republican, fear in the eyes that the media loves. They love to have Republicans who are kind of at their mercy, and you're not at their mercy. They can't control you the way they couldn't control Trump. I think this is a little bit what unnerves them about you. Let me turn to all these January 6th defendants sitting in solitary confinement or in what one writer, Julie Kelly, has called deplorable jail. What do you think needs to be done here? Because the Biden administration is treating these people as if they're Al-Qaeda, as if they're ISIS. They talk about them that way. They tell judges that they are, and they call them seditionists, even though not one of them is charged with sedition. You look at their actual charges, it's things like trespassing, being in a, you know, unauthorized in a public building. So, I mean, the Republican Party, it seems to me, should not sit by with this demonization of these people going on. They need some sort of a defense. How can that be done?
Well, I absolutely agree with you, Dinesh, and this is such an important issue to bring up. This is the hypocrisy, right, of Joe Biden and the Democrats. You know, they support Antifa and BLM riots, calling them peaceful protesters all over the country for the past year. Act Blue, the Democrats' fundraising platform, even fundraises money for BLM. And we have seen what BLM is capable of, which is domestic terrorism. They've attacked regular innocent Americans. They have looted businesses. They've burned cities, attacked police officers, taken over police precincts, torn down federal monuments, attacked federal buildings. If anyone can accuse a group of people or an organization of insurrection, you could definitely accuse Antifa and BLM of insurrection over the past year. Now, we had a riot at the Capitol on January 6th. There were people that broke laws, which I'm, you know, not in support of anything they did at the Capitol on January 6th. And I've been outspoken about that. But we're hearing and thankful to Julie Kelly and others who are reporting this. These people are being held in jail in D.C. under, you know, Mayor Bowser here in what's called the deplorable jail. And they're being treated like political prisoners, just as you mentioned, just like terrorists would be treated at Guantanamo Bay. They're being held in solitary confinement. Reports of sometimes 24 hours a day. I believe now they only get 2.5 hours out of their jail cell. We hear reports about them not being able to speak to their attorneys, not being able to communicate with their families. We hear reports about abuse. We hear all kinds of reports. And this is not who we are as a nation. We shouldn't hold people that are charged with misdemeanor charges, refusing them to be released on bail and just holding them in jail without a set court date. This is wrong. This is human rights abuse, and we demand answers. And so this is something that I'm working on. I'm very concerned about it. I don't think it's fair treatment. We need fair treatment of anyone that has charges against them. We have a justice system for that. And this is where justice is served in court, in a fair process, in a fair judicial process. But what we're hearing about these people that are being held is not fair, and it's not justice, and it isn't who America is.
I commend you for this, Marjorie, because there's been, I would say, a rather alarming silence both on the House, from the House Republicans in general, and on the Senate side. And even some of the GOP stalwarts have tried to stay away from this issue. So I'm really happy that you're willing to confront it. Let me turn for a moment to what I think was a victory yesterday, namely the blocking of the so-called For the People Act. I love these kind of absurd and Orwellian name, For the People Act. Well, I mean, it was a close call, but it was blocked because of the 50-50 deadlock in the Senate. It looks like Republican prospects at this point are hanging a little bit on a thread. Joe Manchin, Kristen Sinema. What's your take on this, and where you think the Democrats are going to go from here with this?
Well, we know that they want to federalize elections. I mean, this is what that was their first big push, right? They care about elections, and I don't think this will go away. I think they'll continue to try to bring it back, but I'm so happy that it failed in the Senate. We'll see what happens on round two or round three of this H.R. 1, this terrible bill. But we need election integrity. And that is so important to Americans all over the country, because we don't feel that we saw real election integrity in the 2020 election. Right now, there's ongoing audits, like in Arizona. There's about to be an audit in Fulton County in my home state of Georgia that I am very interested in. These are things that people should be talking about more, but the Democrats are going to do everything they can to undo fair elections. They want people mailing in their ballots, as many as possible. They want no ID. They want people to just be able to go vote. They want illegals to vote. And that's not election integrity, and that's not fair elections. That's basically inventing and creating ways to cheat elections. And this isn't the process that we need. That's not even legal, in my opinion. But I am excited. Now, I'll mention it again about the Fulton County audit that is up and coming in Georgia. This is one that everyone needs to watch, because there's information that just came out in a Fulton County Commission hearing this past week that Stacey Abrams, who still, you know, has not conceded to the 2018 governor's race in Georgia, she is part owner in an organization called Now Account that handles basically providing labor, hiring people, handling the payroll for a temp service called Happy Faces that worked the Fulton County election. And this is very concerning, because Stacey Abrams also runs an organization called Fair Fight, which is all about elections. And she has done a lot of damage in my home state of Georgia, of rounding up as many people she can, getting them registered and urging them to vote. Now, we're all for people voting, right? But we want fair elections, and we feel like Stacey Abrams doesn't really care about that. She only cares about blue votes. And finding out that she's involved with a company that was actually involved in the counting of ballots, tallying everything, handling ballots for the 2020 election in Fulton County is concerning, and there needs to be an investigation into that.
When we come back, I want to probe even further this issue of election integrity and why it is that the Democrats are so nervous about voter integrity laws that are being passed across the country. We'll be right back. I'm back with Marjorie Taylor Greene. Marjorie, we were talking about voter integrity. And I think it's so revealing that, you know, the left always says, well, you know, you guys are never able to definitively prove that the election was stolen. And I guess Republicans go, well, perhaps not. Perhaps there wasn't a forum to do that. But whatever the case may be, let's try to make sure that this doesn't happen again. So we're going to have these laws that make it clear that only people who are legitimate can vote. And the screaming, the howling, the desire to sort of cancel out these laws through federal and overriding federal law. I mean, doesn't that raise your suspicion that, you know what? This, all of this, and even the censorship that is surrounding discussion of the issue tends to corroborate the suspicion that, yeah, there probably were a whole bunch of shenanigans. Otherwise, you guys would not be freaking out so much about it.
That's right. You know, there's one thing that anyone knows if you've ever competed in a sport or run a race. And if you win, you know for a fact that you won and you are not concerned about any sore loser or anyone challenging your results because you won. If Joe Biden won with 81 million votes, then why in the world is he concerned about any taxpayer or any voter asking questions and wanting to just look into an election and say, can we just check again? There's nothing wrong with that. And if Democrats won so handily the presidential election, it's odd that they lost so many House seats, right? This is still the question. And how did that happen? But if they won so handily, why are they concerned about election laws that really make sure that only legal voters are voting in states with these new election laws? You would think they would have no problem with it. So, you know, what you're saying is absolutely correct, Dinesh, and these are the right questions to ask, is if there's nothing to worry about, why are you worried?
You recently tweeted, Marjorie, this was you were talking about the infrastructure bill, Biden's proposed infrastructure bill, and I understand that there's a lot in it that has very little to do with infrastructure, as that term is understood in the English language. But you spoke specifically as a business owner and a woman business owner of a construction company. Talk a little bit about how you see the infrastructure bill and why you think that there's a certain... What do you see is wrong with all this?
I was furious. The infrastructure bill is what we're supposed to be getting ready to handle in the House. And so my staff and I have been reading through the bill. It's like over 1500 pages. And when I read in the bill how they want to designate women owned businesses, particularly construction companies that are involved in paving roads, which is something I'm very familiar with because I happen to own a construction company. And they want to designate us and they want to categorize women-owned businesses as if we are socially and economically disadvantaged. And I find that extremely insulting as a woman who owns a construction company that has never asked or relied on the government or relied on anyone to be able to do the work that my company has done, to be able to serve my customers, and to be able to function. As a matter of fact, I'm very proud of my company and I'm proud of all the employees that work there because it's through my company and everyone that works there that we're able to achieve all the things that we do, not because the government has made us into a victim or because the government has classified me or anyone else at the company socially and economically disadvantaged. And I don't see myself as a victim. As a matter of fact, I see myself and other women like me that I know that are business owners as well. We see ourselves as the luckiest women on the planet because we're American women. And this is the country, one of the only countries on earth, where we are treated completely equal and we are able to work hard, pursue our goals and achieve our dreams because we're American women. We are not victims of anything or anyone. As a matter of fact, I can tell you myself as a successful business owner in the construction industry, a successful business owner of a gym, and also as a member of Congress, as a woman, I'm not a victim. I am completely capable, independent, and successful based on my own hard work and everything that I've done to achieve my goals. And so this infrastructure bill and its language where it's going to promote minority-owned businesses, women-owned businesses over any company that can just do a good job or say, for example, provide a bid on work that's infrastructure work that we need done that is able to provide a bid at a good dollar amount and then is able to deliver the work that's needed to be done. You see, that's the problem. The Democrats want everything to be about victimization and not about actually doing the work that needs to be done or handling our tax dollars in a responsible way. And then the other part of the infrastructure bill that just has me outraged, and I've been upset about it for a much longer time than this. I've been upset about it before I ever became a member of Congress because I was one of the people reading about it last year. It's not infrastructure. It's the Green New Deal. You see, the Green New Deal is not infrastructure. It's socialism. And what else is in the infrastructure bill? Medicaid. That's not infrastructure. Paying people to stay home and not work. That's not infrastructure. There's many things in this bill that have nothing to do with roads or bridges or waterways or ports or rail, anything to do that is actually infrastructure. This is the Democrats just using a name, lying about it, and passing another massive $1 trillion spending bill that's going to just bring us more government programs, social programs, the Green New Deal, and socialism.
Marjorie, one of the issues you've also been involved in is the trans issue. And I see now that there's New Zealand is going to put a trans athlete, a weightlifter. I happened to see, Debbie and I did this morning, I think this was on Fox and Friends, you know, the woman who would have competed on behalf of New Zealand. And I think very often we don't see the people who are victimized by this. In other words, the people who are denied a chance. We only see the trans person. Oh, I'm breaking new ground for the trans phenomenon and so on. But this woman was saying, hey, listen, you know, when I protested the fact that this is an unfair competition, they told me, listen, lose 30 pounds and go into a different weight class. So I tried to do that. So in all kinds of ways, there are women of talent who obviously want to compete against other women. There's a kind of natural difference of strength between men and women. And so what do you make of the fact that even now at the Olympic level, we're seeing the decimation of women's sports through an ideology that appears to have no regard for human nature or the differences in human nature?
That's right, Dinesh. And thank you for being a man who actually cares about our women's rights. I really appreciate that. You see, this is an infuriating issue for me because I've been an athlete. I know what it's like to compete among women who I considered to be amazing. And I respected them so much because I admired them for how hard they worked. And I was so excited that we could compete together in sports that we love. I also have a daughter who's a D1 athlete because she played her entire life in her sport and earned her scholarship to be able to go to college and play her sport that she loves. So women's sports is a particular issue that I really care about. And I find it appalling, absolutely appalling, that this man that calls himself Laurel Hubbard, and he is not a woman, he is a man, is stealing real women's opportunities to compete in the Olympics. And, you know, women train their entire lives. And let's talk about weightlifting. Yes, this is a sport that we should have been testing, or that we always did test for performance enhancing drugs, testosterone particularly. And this guy, Laurel Hubbard, who grew up very much a biological man, I don't know what kind of hormones he's taking now to try to pretend to be a woman, but he is stealing women's opportunities and what's supposed to be the highest level of sports and competition in the entire world, which is the Olympics. And I am furious with it. I think the entire nation should be outraged. We should be speaking out. We should be putting pressure for biological men to not be allowed to compete in the Olympics. And it's unfair to that young woman that did not get her chance to compete because he stole her place. And everyone that's allowing him in there is responsible for that. And, you know, we also need to take a hard look at people, men and women, that train their entire lives just for that chance to compete. And they only get it every 4 years. Well, later on, when they don't get that opportunity or if they never achieve their goals like they had grown up thinking that they possibly could do, it leads to depression. And for some, it has even led to suicide. So you see, nobody seems to care about the real women, biological women that are training so hard to compete in the Olympics and other sports. They're just putting a guy who is identifying himself as a woman, and they care about his feelings, but yet they don't care about the other real women's feelings that are denied a chance to compete in the Olympics. And this is a no-brainer. I don't even know why it's an issue. We should just call it what it is. It's a complete lie. It's an insult. And that's who the Democrats are. They don't care about women's rights. As a matter of fact, they're in the process of destroying them.
Marjorie, thanks very much for coming on the podcast. Really appreciate it, as always.
Thank you, Dinesh. Thank you so much.
Are you outraged by this idea of court packing? I am. It's a tool of left-wing authoritarians. By the way, Hugo Chavez packed Venezuela's Supreme Court with his socialist cronies and paved the way for his tyrannical regime. And now Joe Biden and America's socialist radicals want to pack our Supreme Court with four new leftist justices. Now, court packing isn't some policy scheme to improve the courts. It's a coup to take away your constitutional freedoms and turn America into a socialist country. That's why the First Liberty Institute, this is the largest legal organization in the nation dedicated to defending religious liberty. By the way, Kelly Shackelford, the president, was in my movie Trump Card. First Liberty has recently launched SupremeCoup.com. SupremeCoup.com to serve as a one-stop shop in the fight against court packing and help patriots like you to learn the truth about what is happening in our courts. Even more important, there's a big take action button that you can click to do your part to stop the Supreme Court coup. Now, if you want to defend our God-given freedoms and stop the left's court packing scheme, head over to SupremeCoup.com/Dinesh. So, SupremeCoup.com/Dinesh. Wokeness, this concept of becoming racially enlightened, isn't just an ideology, it's also a business racket. It is an ideology that quickly became a racket. Here's a remarkable article. It's actually in Real Clear Investigations, part of the Real Clear Politics site. It's called "The High Pressure Business of Selling Woke Corporate Armor." Woke corporate armor. Now, what does this mean? What this really means is that the woke people they start by attacking these corporations and saying, oh, you're racist, oh, you're insensitive, oh, you're reflecting white privilege. And then the corporations go, what can we do? What can we do? And then these guys go, well, listen, we can be consultants, and for a sizable fee, we will advise you on how to avoid the accusations of racism. We will advise you on brand management. So basically what you have here is a replay of the old mafia tactic, which you can see, in movies like Year of the Dragon, which talks about the Chinese mafia. And basically what it is, the Chinese mafia goes into Chinatown and they go from door to door and they collect money. And who are they protecting these storekeepers from? From themselves. They're threatening these storekeepers, but if you pay them, then they won't beat you up. And so this is kind of what's going on here. I discovered this practice many, many years ago when I was talking to a fellow, and this is a guy who was involved with the NASCAR Corporation, and he was telling me about how Jesse Jackson was running a major shakedown operation on NASCAR. Apparently, the founder of NASCAR had made some rather crude or insensitive comment, something to the effect that, you know, blacks, we don't have so many blacks as drivers because blacks don't have enough money, which, by the way, was on the average true. It's a very expensive sport. You kind of need to be a millionaire to be a NASCAR driver. So the point was valid, but put poorly. And so right away, there were all these, Jesse Jackson was fomented this kind of anger against NASCAR. Let's boycott NASCAR, and let's go to the advertisers and tell them to pull their advertising from the networks that show the NASCAR races. And then just as NASCAR was beginning to worry about this, Jesse Jackson shows up, and this time he's playing Mr. Nice Guy. He goes, well, listen, guys, you know what? I can protect you from the brothers. The brothers are getting a little restless. But you know what? If you give me all this money, and if you give me use of your plane, and if you give me um, uh, you um, subcontract with black subcontractors, all of whom, of course, go through me, I will help you to deal with this problem. In other words, I'll help you to deal with this problem that I caused. So Jackson kind of invented the racket. And Sharpton, of course, is a big part of this racket. These guys have basically turned the race business into a business. And here is a woman named Nandini Jammy. She is someone who has been raging against these corporations and organizing boycotts of conservative media because conservative media is racially insensitive, is not woke, and so on. Well, it turns out that having had some success in this area, she was actually trying to pressure Pfizer, Walmart, pull their advertising from Fox News. This woman has now kind of switched gears, Jesse Jackson style, and started her own company, which provides, quote, brand safety training. So the basic idea here is you've got to pay her, and she will tell you how to avoid the minefields of boycotts, how you can avoid upsetting the woke crowd, just to say her, and her buddies. And so a number of corporations are, you know, going for it. Corporations like Disney now have all kinds of consultants that advise them about how they deal with insensitive material. The other guy who's profiting from this racket, Ibram Kendi, this is kind of the critical race theory guy. So he starts off, oh, I'm on a crusade, I'm fighting for social justice. But pretty soon you discover he's raking in hundreds of thousands of dollars from companies, all of which are like, Ibram, you coming in, you tell us how we can be anti-racist over here. And Ibram is like, yeah, with my advice, you're going to be woke. You're not going to be accused of racism. So basically this protection racket is running. And it is a way of cashing in on the race business. Now, the reason that these boycotts have become so effective is because of social media. You can create the kind of online mob that goes to these corporations and screams, racist, racist, racist. And the corporation doesn't know. It's actually 20 people, but they've sent 4,000 emails. And you think, my God, there's some kind of unbelievable snowball of outrage building. So the outrage is manufactured. It's concocted. It makes a perfect opportunity for these kind of designated race activists to then jump in and go, hey, listen, we can call off the dogs, we can call off the mob, we can stop the snowball, because they know the snowball is actually eight of their buddies, and if they probably pass the money around, they can quickly bring this to a halt. And then the corporation goes, phew, that was a major problem averted, thank you, it's so great that we have you guys advising us. So what you get here is that social justice is really not about social justice for these guys. You have to realize these are race entrepreneurs. They're not real entrepreneurs because they can't make anything that people ordinarily would want to buy, but they found a market niche. And the market niche is, how do you traffic in this commodity, this delicate commodity called brand reputation? And what makes the whole thing particularly ridiculous and hypocritical and even sick is that they are trying to protect these corporations from accusations that they themselves have generated. We seem to be facing a virtual epidemic of racial hoaxes. And if you think about it, this is a real puzzle in our society. I realize that in other contexts, people do fake horrible things happening. So for example, someone might fake, someone broke into my car, somebody robbed my house. But typically when you fake something like that, you have a motive. I want to collect insurance money. So there's a commercial motive that fully explains why people would attempt that kind of a fake. But why would you fake a racial incident? Why would you deface yourself or do graffiti or say horrible things about yourself? Or set fire to things and then blame it on a white supremacist who doesn't even exist? Why would someone do that? The history of the fake racial incident goes back to the 1980s. Some of you will remember the Tawana Brawley case, where this woman claimed to have been horribly brutalized, a young teenager. This actually, the publicity surrounding the incident made the career of Al Sharpton, launched this kind of weird character to the public stage, and he's still around. And then it turned out that she made it up. She wasn't attacked. She actually smeared the excrement and all this horrible stuff on herself. So at that time, I think people thought, this is anomalous. This woman has obviously got something deeply wrong with her. It's pathological. But you can say that about one incident, but now it appears like there's a fake racial incident that goes on every day. Let me give a couple of just recent examples. Here's one from high school. This is Bear Lake High School in Minnesota. There were slogans that appeared on the school, "Go back to Africa." Turns out when they did an investigation, a black student was responsible. So a black student is pretending to be a white student and sending "Go back to Africa" messages to himself or herself. I mean, no, actually it's a woman, to herself. And that raises the question, why? Here's another one. The student says that she did this to call attention to racism at the school. Well, wait a minute. If there's all this racism at the school, why would you have to stage an incident to do that? I mean, imagine, you know, Jews in the 1930s staging Nazi beatings. I was beaten by a Nazi. I want us to call attention to the horrible Nazis. Well, wait a minute. You don't need to stage those incidents because Nazi atrocities were all over the place. There was plenty of evidence for it. You didn't have to make it up. So there's no need to make it up where the phenomenon is actually widespread. Here's another incident. This is at Viterbo University in Wisconsin. There were protests for months over apparently hate crimes on the campus. In fact, one of the leaders of the protest was a student named Victoria Unanka, a kind of Black Lives Matter activist who had spoken at a Black Lives Matter rally in March where hundreds of students were in attendance. And she claimed that there was a fire in her dorm that had been set as a racial message to her. And this obviously caused, you can just imagine the professors and the administrators doing backward somersaults to deal with this problem. Oh, systemic racism and so on. Finally, it's come, you know, to Viterbo University. Well, guess what? Victoria Unanka set the fire herself. She's now admitted doing it. And so what you have here is a truly, I think, pathological phenomenon, but a pathological phenomenon that's kind of widespread. Now, let's think about why people would do this. And I have sort of a theory about it. Racism of the old sort, the N-word, go back to Africa, is extremely rare in our society. It hardly ever occurs. And yet, these students are told from morning to night by their teachers, by their professors, in some ways by their culture, that this is a systemically racist society. So they learn about racism. And of course, they know historically there was this racism. And so they invoke this racism to explain why they, the students themselves, are facing difficulties and hardships in their life. They're doing horribly in school, or they're affirmative action students and they're having trouble in the math class, or they realize that the other students are a lot smarter than them, which is, of course, the natural effect of affirmative action. You admit students with lower grades and test scores, they're going to find that the other students have higher grades and test scores and more academic training and preparation than they do. So they have these anxieties, this self-doubt. And so here is the explanation for it. Racism. But of course, historic racism is not enough. The racism has to be something that affects them directly. So they believe it. They know it's gotta be there, but they don't see it. In fact, everybody's really nice to them. If they go in and start screaming at the professor changes their grade. If they go screaming at the administrator and kick over his waste paper basket, he then says, "Well, give me your list of non-negotiable demands. I'll see what I can do." So far from being treated badly, they are treated with deference. They're put on a pedestal. And so there's a kind of disconnect between their deep belief that racism is the explanation for their problems and the unavailability of public evidence for it. And this is when their mind goes, well, you know what? Since we kind of know it's there, it's kind of like if someone tells you there's a ghost in your room and you've come to depend on the ghost. The ghost explains why you have all these twitches and you behave in these strange fashions. And so somehow the ghost has now become part of your identity. You need the ghost and you don't see the ghost. So you kind of feel like, I've got to make up the ghost. I saw a ghost. Where? You know, so you've got this kind of desire to invent, at least invent, if not for your own satisfaction, for public satisfaction. See, the things I've been telling you are true. See, I've been telling you that Viterbo University is institutionally racist. And now look, here is this fire in my dorm. Clear proof of what I've been saying. So in the absence of evidence, evidence sort of has to be manufactured. And I think what this shows is not just the fact that we're dealing with some disturbed students, we are, but when you look at the reaction of the surrounding campus, we see that we have disturbed institutions and a disturbed ideology that is enabling, in some ways even encouraging, these hoaxes and lies. The Summer Olympics is coming to Tokyo next month in July. I'm looking forward to it. I'm a big fan of the Olympics, big fan of track and field. I think I must have been in my teens when I first saw the Olympics in India and kind of became hooked. And I've tried to watch as much as I can ever since. So it is with some sadness that I see that we're going to see, I think, in Tokyo, the woke phenomenon, racial politics, push its way into the Olympic stadium. Now, here's something a little outrageous I just see. U.S. Olympic athlete Chelsea Wolf threatens to burn flag on the podium if she wins a medal. Wow, this is from Fox 13 News. And this is a BMX freestyle rider, Chelsea Wolf, who says that she's hoping that she'll win an Olympic medal, quote, so I can burn a U.S. flag on the podium. Wow. Imagine the effect of that. Imagine the image that's going to send to the world. Burn the U.S. flag on the podium. Now, this is a woman who's qualified as an alternate, so I don't think medals are really in the cards. But it's the sentiment here, I think, that is so disgusting. Now, I suppose, I don't know if this is surprising or not, Chelsea Wolf is trans, and that's her cause. She thinks that there's a movement in the United States against the trans people. And I'm quoting her now. I take a stand against fascism because I care about this country and I'm not going to let it fall into the hands of fascists. So she claims that she's not really anti-American, but she's against, quote, fascism in America and apparently denying the legitimacy of the trans phenomenon or questioning the trans political agenda, in her view, amounts to fascism. What it has to do with real fascism, I have absolutely no idea. Real fascism is just about state control, the socialist agenda. Of course, there was the anti-Semitic phenomenon for Nazi National Socialism, although not necessarily for other forms of fascism. So what's encouraging this? Well, sadly, what's encouraging this a little bit, I'm sorry to say, is the U.S. Olympic Committee. Why? Because the U.S. Olympic Committee has decided that it's going to allow raised fists and kneeling during the national anthem at the U.S. Olympic trials. The U.S. Olympic Committee has issued a statement that's saying it's kind of, they've been having a process to sort of go through this. And they're saying that there are certain forms of protest, and they're kind of clear what you can and can't do. Like, you can't lie down on the track to block a race or something, but what you can do is you can hold up a fist, you can kneel during the anthem, you can wear hats or face masks with phrases like Black Lives Matter, as long as you're doing it, quote, in the name of social or racial justice on behalf of so-called marginalized groups, it's apparently okay. So evidently, other forms of protest are not okay, but this is a preferred form of protest that they're going to allow. Now, what is really wrong with all this? I think what is wrong with all this is it is an abuse of public trust. Let's think of why people go to the Olympics. Why do they watch the Olympics? They watch the Olympics because they want to see sport. They want to see human excellence. They want to see people compete. And it's a wonderful idea, and by the way, with its roots in ancient Greece, people from all different countries competing in a sportsmanlike way according to a uniform set of rules and in all kinds of wonderful displays of human achievement and strength and speed and power. And it's fantastic. But that's why people come. That's what people want to watch. And the athletes, when they know this, they decide, okay, well, people are coming to watch me run or coming to watch me box or coming to watch me cycle. But since I have their attention, why don't I use the occasion to propagandize them? In other words, why don't I use the podium not as a recognition of sport, but to establish myself as a champion of social justice? Now, again, this is a kind of abuse of why people are there to see you. They're there to see you perform. And what you're doing is you're kind of sticking it in their face by saying, I'm going to take the opportunity to propagandize you on something unrelated certainly in any direct form, to my sporting achievement, which is responsible for me being here. So this to me is divisive in a very bad way. I mean, certain forms of divisiveness are okay. Politics is about division, by the way. But this is the kind of divisiveness that alienates people from the things that they love. They love sports, they come to watch sports, and then they're disgusted to see people who are sticking their politics in their face, particularly if it's not my politics. I don't approve of these messages. I don't agree with your interpretation of these facts. Not that I'm against Black Lives Matter. I think Black Lives do matter. But I'm against Black Lives Matter, the organization. I'm against the clenched fist. I'm against that view of America. I'm against the blaming of the national anthem or the 4th of July for the offenses that are being alleged here. So this whole ensemble of political packaging offends me, outrages me, and it's going to make me more likely turn off the television. And so I don't know why the U.S. Olympic Committee or the International Olympic Committee would condone any of this. I think to me it reflects the fact that one after the other, our institutions are kind of proving their vulnerability, their fragility. They're succumbing one after the other to the pressures of woke politics. And as a result, cutting us off, alienating us from sporting events themselves. Just 10 more days for the Dinesh MyPillow book and movie promo. So I hope you'll go on the MyPillow site or call them and spend $250 or $500, even $1,000 on Mike Lindell's wonderful merchandise. I want to talk now about his comfortable bed sheets. He found the best cotton in the world. This is in a place where the Sahara, the Nile, and the Mediterranean Sea kind of come together. They create the ideal weather conditions for growing cotton. The MyPillow Giza Dream bed sheets, they're made with this long staple cotton. By the way, they're going to be the most comfortable sheets you ever own. The first night you sleep on them, I don't think you're going to want to sleep on anything else. Now, the Giza Dream sheets are available in a whole variety of colors, like all of Mike's products. 60-day money-back guarantee, 10-year warranty. So right now, buy one, get one free by calling 800-876-0227 and use promo code Dinesh. For a limited time again, buy one, get one free. Call 800-876-0227 or go to MyPillow.com. Don't forget to use promo code Dinesh. One of the things I find very troubling and also very hollow from the left is the continuing expressions of disdain, contempt for the American founding and for the American founders. And sometimes this is in the guise of the idea of a living constitution. Namely, the founders created a constitution, but you know, Dinesh, it was an agricultural society. Those guys were farmers. Their knowledge was narrow, limited. That's not the world we live in now. We have so much more. We have technology. We have computers. We have access to vastly greater troves of information. This kind of rhetoric started, by the way, with the progressives about a century ago, with Woodrow Wilson, people like this who thought that they were much smarter than the founders and that their generation, that America had become smarter. And we find this rhetoric with us even now, that we have to somehow transcend the founders, not just that they were bigots, but they were bigots because their whole minds and the minds of their age were narrow and were shaped by a narrow set of practices, including slavery. Now, the great political scientist and scholar Forrest MacDonald, I recommend to you his book, which I've read more than once. I have it here with me. It's called Novus Ordo Seclorum, a wonderful book that doesn't just talk about the ideas of the founding, but recreates the world of the founding. And the intellectual world of the founding. And MacDonald gave the Jefferson Lecture for the Humanities in 1987. I went back. I was at the lecture. I loved it. But I'd forgotten about it. And so I went back and pulled it off the National Endowment for the Humanities website. And I want to read a few lines from it because it talks about the intellectual world of the founding. And you get an idea of how rare this collection of 55 men in Philadelphia was, how it would be very difficult, I think impossible, to duplicate that, not just now, but at any subsequent period in American history. It's almost as if America was blessed, providentially blessed, to have this concentration of wisdom and talent in one place, in one room. And now MacDonald, Riley observes that of the 55 people in Philadelphia, 35 had gone to college. And he goes, you may say, so what? Big deal, 35. But he goes, okay, let me tell you what it was like to go to college. First of all, people went to college at a younger age, typically 15 or 16. And he, MacDonald pulls up the college entry requirements for King's College, which is, by the way, now Columbia University, at the time of the founding. Here we go. Just to enter college during the 18th century, he writes, it was necessary, among other things, to be able to read and translate from the original Latin into English, quote, the first three of Tully's Select Orations and the first three books of Virgil's Aeneid. So from Latin into English. And, he says, you had to be able to translate the first 10 chapters of the Gospel of St. John from Greek into Latin. From Greek into Latin. In addition, you have to be, quote, expert in arithmetic and to have, quote, a blameless moral character. Now, can you think of one person alive now of this age who could do these things? I can't. I've never met anyone who could. And then, says MacDonald, it would have been easy in America, he says in 1787, to have not one, but possibly five, he goes, five, possibly 10 constitutional conventions with men of similar capability. Wow. He says, first of all, just let's look at some of the people who are not at the Philadelphia Convention. Jefferson wasn't there. Neither was John Adams. Neither was John Hancock, nor Noah Webster, nor Sam Adams, nor Benjamin Rush, nor John Jay, nor Fisher Ames. All those people were elsewhere. They could have formed, with along with others, a convention of their own. So what MacDonald is getting at is that this was America's sort of golden age. And he talks about the kind of things that Americans at that time read and talked about and knew. He goes, it was an age of newspapers. There were newspapers all over the place. And by the way, newspapers, there were more newspapers in America than there were in France. And France was the most literate country in Europe. And ordinary people had a deep knowledge of what was going on in the world, not just in America. In fact, MacDonald says that newspapers at that time didn't cover local news. Why? Because they assume, well, you live in Philadelphia. You obviously know what's going on in Philadelphia. Philadelphia then, by the way, was a small town. So the newspapers only covered what was going on in Madrid or Moscow or London or Paris or even Martinique or Jamaica. Now, the ordinary Americans were familiar with the classics. Their reading was widespread. Here's an example of kind of how, what you could count on. There was a newspaper publisher in 1786, Isaiah Thomas, and he had come across a literary controversy over Alexander Pope's translation of the Iliad. Now, Pope was, of course, a poet. He translates the Iliad. And Samuel Johnson, who didn't like the translation, said, "It is beautiful, sir, but is it Homer?" Meaning, is he actually accurately translated the Iliad? So this guy, Isaiah Thomas, goes, you know what? I'm now quoting from MacDonald. Thomas gave his readers the opportunity to decide for themselves by printing Pope's translation and the original Greek in parallel columns. So you read the Greek, you read Pope's translation, you figure out if it's faithful to the original. Wow. Imagine doing that in a newspaper. Imagine if the New York Times were to do that today. Americans were familiar with the ideas of political economy. Political economy here, what we call now economics, Adam Smith, David Hume. They were familiar also with, philosophical legacy. And if you look by and large, I mean, think about the Federalist Papers, which is the most, perhaps the most famous American political tract written around the time of the Constitution, written, by the way, by Madison, and Hamilton and John Jay. But they took the name Publius, which is a reference to the Roman Republic. And they expected that their readers would know who Publius is. And if you read the Federalist Papers, it's assigned to these days in college. And it's hard going for a lot of people because of the multiplicity of its references, the complexity of its ideas. But this was published in normal newspapers. It was published in New York and then reprinted in newspapers around the country in the expectation that the ordinary American, we're talking about farmers, the ordinary American farmer could read and understand and follow these kinds of debates that were going on about the government. One of the fundamental concepts, McDonald says, that was being discussed was the idea of civic virtue. And by civic virtue, he doesn't mean, when we say virtue today, we basically mean things like sexual continence and so on. But virtue here for the founders and for the founding generation referred to what could be called public virtue. What is public virtue? I'm now reading from McDonald. He goes, both public and virtue, meaning the words, derive from Latin roots signifying manhood. So while we focus these days on what you could almost call the feminine virtues, the masculine virtues are what? They are, quote, discipline, strength, courage, endurance, industry, frugality, and unremitting devotion to the community of virtuous men. So interestingly, this idea of public virtue is individualistic. You've got to improve your own moral character, but you also have to participate in, you can call it the community of virtue. You've got to participate in public activities designed to make society reach, if you will, its better self. So not just your better self, but your community's better self. So what we're talking about here is a founding milieu that is anchored in history. Not only the founders themselves, but the people in America at the time had an awareness of history, of ancient history, of the fact that America was in some important ways breaking with Europe, but at the same time continuing traditions of Europe, importing, for example, the English common law. Many Americans, for example, were familiar with Blackstone's commentaries on the law. They were familiar with the political ideas of John Locke. The founders, for example, if there was a single philosopher that could be called the philosopher of the American founding, it was probably Locke. The founders also frequently quoted Tacitus, they quoted Aristotle. They didn't quote Plato so much, but they loved Plutarch. The writer who is Greek, but living in the Roman Empire and writing about literary matters, historical matters, and government. Plutarch, I believe, had perhaps the biggest library of any educated Roman of his time. So this is the world of the founding. We shouldn't be too quick to believe, oh, we're smarter. We're not smarter. Oh, we know more. We don't know more. Oh, we have a better understanding of human nature. We don't have a better understanding of human nature. The founders, in a sense, created something permanent, a new order, as they called it, for the ages. That's the meaning of the title of McDonald's book, The Novus Ordo Seclorum. And I think that America will be okay to the degree that we stick with this founding architecture. On the other hand, if we move away from it, if we start abandoning it, we do so, I think, at our peril.
Subscribe to the Dinesh D'Souza podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify, or watch on Rumble, YouTube, and SalemNow.com.